All right. So I want to talk about this in three basic ways. One is the general points of the book, and then the second will be the magical kitchen, and then the third one will be the track of love and the track of fear. Okay? Those are sort of the three basic elements of the book. And so I put some of the general points up here, but what stood out for you? What was the Toltec? What were the Toltecs? Is everybody familiar with what Toltec is and who the Toltecs were?
Well, they were ancient Amerindian.
Right. They were pyramid builders. They were theoretically the Toltecs were a generation who still remembered the sort of the Atlantean consciousness. It's the same energies that went and created the Celtic religions and the Egyptian religions. There was a level of consciousness, a level of awareness of how to live energetically and consciously that was very present, what they call in the ancient times, in early development of man's consciousness. There was this group, and they split up over the earth, and the Toltecs were Aztec, you know, in their region, but they were there just as there are many different religions within religions. There are people who are able to become conscious of and channel levels of awareness. They're guided to this understanding of life in a different way. And so Toltec was the study. He called it that they were scientists and artists of life. Of really the their whole idea was that you need to study life's energy. If you only study life's function, you miss almost all of it. If you study the energy that resides behind the function, then you're really understanding what's happening. And that's why when you read the Carlos Castaneda books, you read these books, you read anybody who talks about the Toltec, they are these people that are not hooked into all those hooks, all those things that we have hooked into in relationship, in society. And they stand outside of society as an individual person, which is very rare on our planet. We're brought up to hook our energy into society, culture, family, all the lower chakra things. And they spend their life recognizing that they have to break those ties, that to be able to understand energy, they have to understand their own energy field. And that's how they experience the world. They experience the universe through their energy field. So they were studying what we're studying here way back, but doing it from a experiential place. So
do they start with like children when they're very young?
I don't know. I read all the Carlos Castaneda books, which when I was a kid, and I thought, wow, this is some amazing stuff. And I did some work with Florinda Donner and a couple of Carlos Castaneda's the witches that he worked with that were all they were both trained by Don Miguel or Don Juan, who was his master. But normally they come into this as an adult practice. And so then the second part of that is somewhere in here is that you're all just as disciplined as those Toltec seers are. You're just disciplined around your defense. Everybody, remember he said that we live in a mental institution? Right? It's because we practice. One of the things that he talked about in there was he talked about how you have a very difficult time remembering all of the elements of your childhood except for the traumas. Okay? Because he was saying that it's all a dream. You created all of it anyway. And dreams, by their nature, fade very quickly. Yeah. They're supposed to. Mm-hmm. Unless we use this incredible God-given right we have to fixate on what we think is the most important thing to remember. And then what we'll do is we'll fixate on our traumas and our wounds and the things that we're the most wounded by, and then create a life from that. And that was why he was calling it the mental institution. Because we don't fixate on our core quality, that childlike aliveness and investigation and joy. We fixate on how to avoid getting hurt again. Yeah.
Why?
It's my theory on that is that the cerebral cortex was not designed to which is what it's capable of, becoming conscious of God. It was designed to get away from Tyrannosaurus Rex and saber-toothed tiger and to kill other people so you can survive. You know, it was not designed, with the Atlanteans and the Toltecs, it was initially programmed for consciousness. It was like we were probably this amazing creation of souls that said, look, these people are going to become so conscious. And then we used it in a very poor way. When we became, you know, conscious of good and evil, we chose evil as our focus. You can focus on whatever you want in the dream. The key is, what do you focus on? Do you focus on your sensations and your feelings and the aliveness within you? Or do you focus on the defense and the protection and the isolation and the never again? And is that how you have done your discipline? You know, and that's really it. It's really important to understand that every one of you, no matter how you talk about your discipline, you are so incredibly disciplined. Every one of you has intense discipline. Now, of course, it's Rule Keeper Weekend, and we can just point to the Rule Keeper and say, well, of course, you're the most disciplined. But they're not. Each one of you, no matter what your defense is, it takes every ounce of your energy to keep your defense alive, because it doesn't exist. Your defense, your wounds, that thing that happened to you 35 years ago is over. Things that happened to you this morning are ancient history. The only way you keep that going is by memory. And focus. And then you recreate the dream right now based on that memory. Okay, don't ever forget that. Don't ever forget that. That was bad. I never want to forget that. And so then I'll recreate and I'll recreate and recreate. So now it's amazing how in your relationships now you recreate a lot of those same problems. Well, it's because you're creating the dream. Yes?
Quick question about memory process. If you are in your core,
yep.
Does memory become less important?
That you hardly even think about it, because you don't define yourself by anything.
I'm having early dementia. I do feel like I'm starting to lose my core more, and I cannot remember anything anymore.
Perfect.
I'm always forgetting.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah.
Maddie, for you, it's
yeah.
Thank you for you with dementia.
Is it dementia or demented? No. Yeah, no, I've told the story a number of times, but when we went and did our summer retreat out down in Anguilla, we got so stupid that we got shirts called the Stupid Club shirts. And it was the first time I realized what consciousness was. Consciousness has nothing to do with thinking. It's when you are not thinking and just being in relationship, because your body knows exactly what to do in your life. Your fear that you didn't know came from what? It came from the injustice of not being seen for who you were as a child. You had this huge injustice that I wasn't seen as who I was as a child, and eventually you realize that I don't know who I am. And so then we go to school, and what happens at school? I don't know how to do math. I don't know how to. So we learn that when you learn, the things you need to remember are the things other people want you to remember. And you'll figure out who you are by how good you are at English, how good you are at math, how good you are at this, how good you are at being what they want you to be. And so we have to remember who we are. And so we practice and practice and practice remembering who we are, so it's going to be okay. Because we learned the injustice that we took in was that we're not enough. Who we are isn't enough. We're not good enough. We're not perfect. If we were perfect, our parents would have loved us the way we are. But they don't love us the way we are. They yell at us for what we're doing. And so then we recreate that self over and over again until we finally think that's who we are. And that's why the mental institution. And that mental institution is when we talk about your profile. You know, it's pretty easy. There's five institutions. Poor me. you know, people pleaser, rule keepers, enforcers, and thinkers. And they have their little rooms. It's like divisions of the mental institution. Okay? And so what else did he talk about in there? Compassion, right? How do you get compassion for other people? You realize you're in the mental institution too. Okay? Our specialness is means our specialness means we're in the special institution room. And it means that you're in that special room because you don't know you're crazy. But when you know you're crazy, when you take on, that's why we teach you the profiles, when you can take on that quality and say, oh my God, look at how freaking crazy I am, now you can have compassion for other people who are also in their crazy. But if you think that I'm just going to get it together, just next time, it's the next thing, it's tomorrow, it's the next week, it's the next month, it's the next, I'll finally get it together. You are nuts. You will never get it together. It's not how the dream works. It's a dream. Think about trying to pull your dream together at night while you're sleeping. Let's get it together. Come on. It's almost there. It doesn't. The dream constantly evolves. The universe is not worried whether you have any opinion of it or not. It is flowing effortlessly, beautifully. It's not trying to do anything. We try to do everything because we learned that we have to try to be ourselves. And that's the bit. That's the heart. When the heart, and when you try to be yourself, how do you do it? Through vows, right? Every vow you took was a vow against being who you were and somebody who you, and then you vowed to be something else. I'm going to vow to be me. And then what do you do with your energy? This beautiful, flowing, childlike, I'm going to be a butterfly today. I'm going to be a, you know, no. I vowed to be a good child. Don't have any idea what that is. But when my parents said, be a good child, I'm like, vow. And then I try to fight my energy into this good child position. And then I make another vow and another vow. And pretty soon, I am my vows. And you run your energy through your vows. And that's why I give you those vows, because you really, really need to investigate those and take a good look at the kinds of vows you've made. Okay? Is everybody with me on that? Understand? It's okay to be crazy. It's your only chance. It's a great song. It's going to be our last song, I think, we'll do this year. Seal does a song called Crazy. Got to be a little crazy. We're never going to make it unless we're a little crazy. All right. So what else? What else generally? The skin disease. How did everybody like that? That idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what happens? How do you trigger your skin disease? What's that? What's the thing he said? You know that. What lances him open for you? Yeah, and so what's your most powerful judgment? A vow, right? So your vow by its nature stabs you and keeps your wounds open. So your vow to be good, vow to be strong, vow to be always right, vow to never listen, out of whatever it is that you, I'm always going to be, la-da-da. That by its nature, every time you do it, you lance that wound. Because the wound was that I'm not that. The reason you made that vow is because you weren't that at all. So the things you stick to so hard, so firm in your life, okay, are the lie. They're always the lie. Because you're a child. I mean, think about when you were a little kid, and you were actually playfully, happily, enjoying. There was nothing that you fixated on like that. Yeah, you okay?
Okay. No, I just want to jump because this is not real. You're not real. It's just, it's
right.
I just jump.
Right.
Go ahead and jump.
Go ahead and jump.
No, I did my hands.
Okay. So one of the things that you want to let in while we're doing this is, and I want you to sort of take what I'm doing here and how I teach. This is how I play. I play with ideas. This is play for me. Okay? And I know I play with things that sort of can bring up triggering things like that, but understand that until you can play with these notions, these crazy, crazy notions of who you are, you can never get out of the box. The box just always, you know, it's the myth of Sisyphus. The rock, you just get it that close. It's that close. I could just about get the rock up over the edge. And then it rolls back down on you for an eternity. And that what rolls back down on you in eternity are your thoughts, your beliefs, your vows, this firmness. And this weekend we're talking about rule keepers. And they are the ones, when you are rigidly an adult, you are the biggest child. Just understand. The person who is the most rigid in the way they deal with life is the person who's the most afraid of being fully alive. Okay? So, and that's why I was saying the knowledgeable achiever, the rule keeper, has this delicate little baby heart, this childlike softness and love in them that they protect with walls of iron and steel and titanium. But when that breaks, there's this playful sort of, they love to play. They're, you know, all those games that they had to be great and compete at, they could actually enjoy someday. You know, it's not like I just have to win. It's I can really enjoy this playfulness. Okay, what else we got generally before we move to the kitchen? I'm sorry. I mean, I have some things up here, but what about injustice? Domestication. You've read the Four Agreements and this again. Mm-hmm. Well, we went over it, but how's it for you? I mean, how did...
Yeah, that's not a problem, but I'm trying to... So if you stay in your core regarding injustice and domestication, isn't it really just about letting it go and not putting more energy into it?
Yeah, yeah. Basically,
sense about the poor and the rich and all these classes and things that are happening in institutions across the country, which is phenomenal. The people in power are going crazy with power, right? Now.
Right.
And I'm just like, ugh. And when I go into defense.
Yep.
And it's like doesn't really help me or anybody else.
Right.
I'm trying to it is what it is, and stay in my space of trying to be centered and not get so crazy about it.
So anybody else, what do you do? What's she describing right there? Because all of you do it all the time. You all have a massive level of sense of injustice in your lives. It just rolls through your day. There's 4, 5, 6, 10 times a day you are dealing with injustice, and depending upon how dissociated you are, you know, it's just a judgment, or it's just that's just them, or you know, you just project it out. But there's something else that happens, and it was going on in you. What happens? Right.
You recreate. It keeps going in a vicious circle.
Right. So what happens is that wound, that injustice that you had, is being brought back into the present moment. But the problem is that it's not here. And when it's not here, you don't have any opponent to vent that energy on. You're in fight or flight, okay? And the same sort of injustice that was levied on you as a child is the same type of injustice that you always fight in the world. And so what you bring up is you bring up that need to heal the wound, but the problem is that there's nothing here to do it. It was just an idea. And you can't fight an idea. It always wins. Okay? Yeah.
If it's just an idea and it always wins, if you don't let the idea get into your system, how can it win?
Because you can't stop it. If it's a vow, it happens automatically. You have set into the world automatic triggers to trigger that vow.
Okay.
To prove it, to justify it.
I don't want the vow anymore.
No, but that's so. But what was happening was that you were having this emotional reaction to something that doesn't exist, and so your body says, "Well, there's nothing here. I can't fight anything." But you can. You can decide that when I feel that way, I call somebody. I go punch my punching bag. I, you know, do something. I move energy. Now, going and punching the punching bag is a great way to just vent off energy, but it doesn't really change your life. It's just something, as he talked about in the book, you know, you can go have another $100, you know, crazy session with your therapist and bang the table, and then you go out, and as soon as your spouse walks by again, what happens? You right again, run right back to the therapist and do it. So that's not really solving the issue.
Part of what Gene's talking about, though, happens on TV. You know, it's CNN.
That's why you can't watch that.
It's
the bombardment. You
know. Right, so it is there. It is in front of you. It is in the present moment. But then again, it's not. And that's the problem.
Well, I am seeing the differentiation between that, just energetically and emotionally for me.
Right.
Shifting, but
right.
It is a deep bottle when I just.
It is. And so the other thing you talked about was that the brain gets this illusion that we can be in relationship with big issues. Right?
Oh my God.
And he said in the book, he said it so beautifully. I mean, he has such words of wisdom. It's like you've never been in relationship with anything other than one person. Anytime you try to be in relationship with a concept, you lose.
I get that better.
You get that? Yeah. So if you really want to do something about Japan, it's like, oh my God, these people are starving, and then, you know, find a person that you can then connect with that is doing work for them, doing, you know, find some way to connect with a person. And you'll find that your life works a lot better when you have that. I'm looking for some kind of relationship, direct relationship, that will help me work through this problem. Help me work through this, and support this anger, this frustration, this, you know, whatever it is. But against the big picture, we try to be in relationship with big groups of people, and you can't. You can't be in relationship with this group of people, even though this group of people has an energy and has a personality. You have to be in relationship with each person in the group, and if you try to deal with them as a whole, you are dealing with your own illusion of who they are, rather than actually dealing with them one person at a time. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah.
So I'm kind of reading over Patty's shoulder, and he said that the three simple points of healing is truth, forgiveness, and self-love. And yesterday you said that none of us have ever forgiven anyone.
Right.
So I'm wondering what real forgiveness is.
We were going to do that this morning. Talk about that's going to. That's like a whole hour talk, but the and discussion. Forgiveness happens when. What are the? So let's write them down. What are the three? I'm sorry.
Truth. Forgiveness.
Profile. Forgiveness. And
self-love.
Self-love.
Is that self-love all paper?
Yes. The truth. The first thing, the truth is who am I? Okay. And then he talked about doing your half of the work. The first truth is that you can't ever do any work for anybody else. You can never clean anybody else's garbage. If you try, you're just disrespecting them. Right. Disrespect is any time you try to clean someone else's garbage for them. You can't. You make them weaker by doing that. Okay? Forgiveness is for all the times you weren't in your truth.
That's a lot of forgiving.
It's a huge ton. It's a ton. Because we've projected...
How can you forgive yourself then?
You can only forgive yourself. You can never forgive another person because by the nature of forgiving them, you're forgiving something that it doesn't exist. You forgiveness happens when the heart opens. So forgiveness is the heart. Forgiveness happens when like a child. He talked about forgiveness very very simply. A child, two children are playing. Okay, I had this happen. My children were at the daycare, and my son. Was going through a biting stage. And many of the children were walking out with these little bite marks on them. And so the children were getting bitten and like, oh, don't you do that, and then they'd just be back playing again. The parents came in. Your son's a biter, isn't he? They hated me forever. That's how crazy parents are. It wasn't an event that happens that you let go of. It's an event to justify being miserable forever.
Labeling.
And labeling and judging and holding on to it, and I'm never going to forgive you. So the parents never forgive because they don't know how to forgive as an adult. An adult is taught you never forget what hurt you. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So now you don't know, by the nature of being an adult, not a child, you have this built into you. How do you forgive? Well, forgiveness means that the person has got to, is second chakra. They got to pay up. They better pay the same amount. If you lost a finger, they better lose a finger. If you did this, they better get this. That's the second chakra. That's second chakra love. You know, it's sort of love. You know. Yes.
Notice, and I don't know if this is just a fallacy, the way men and women, forgive differently. But I've always been fascinated where men get an argument, and it's either done with fist fighting or whatever. They have it out, and the next minute they're having a beer together.
Right.
Whereas women tend to hold on forever.
Right.
Do the men really forgive, or are they just compartmentalizing? I mean,
it depends on what, I mean, we're dealing with different, you know, just like with women, each of the profiles forgives very differently. Rule keeper men never forgive. They just dismiss you. You're just an idiot. Yeah. They might also punch you, you know, which then sort of makes it more of a man kind of thing and brings it back to childhood. Because two people that are actually fighting are two, children aren't afraid to fight. Remember, he said that the greatest injustice was not that you were spanked for doing something that you didn't deserve. You know, he talked about playing with the guitar, right? Okay, he was just playing. The child's just playing with the guitar. It looks like a toy to a child. But the parent comes in and spanks him for doing it. Massive injustice. But then the ultimate injustice was when you raised your hand to say you're not going to hit me again to your parent. Then they escalated. You have no right to fight back. That's a bad person. That was a bad behavior. That was a bad thing. But now you're a bad person when you do that. Now you learn that you're not even allowed to fight. So at least men who actually mix it up and punch each other can go back to their childhood. Okay? Women are taught that you're never allowed to do that. And so they never even have an option. At that point, they have to be, you have to just be nice. And you have to deal with things. And, so then they kill you with all sorts of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. There's all kinds of... There's all kinds of ways you get killed. It doesn't have to be the one of these. So, but yeah, no, that animal quality of I always liked, if you see ducks in the pond, and they'll be like, you're in my space. No, I'm not. You're in my space. That's my woman over there. Whatever. And they go, "Rawr!" and then they they battle and then they move apart and they ruffle. And they just keep swimming on. It's like, okay, yeah, we're back to... That was over. But once the mind has the memory capacity, it remembers the emotional wound that went along with it. The reason they did that was because they didn't like me. The reason... It had nothing to do with the action. Nothing that's ever happened to you is actually a wound, except for the way you remembered it. Okay? The way you've remembered it makes it a wound. Because your body's totally healed right now from whatever it was. Even Maddie, who fell out of the sky in a helicopter. Okay? Even though her body probably talks to her occasionally from those places, it's a present moment experience. Okay? She could use that to avoid the rest of her life. Oh my God, I'm never going to get a car. No, forget helicopters. Oh my God, there's a helicopter. I got to run away. You know, she could have used it for all kinds of crazy woundology. Or, you know what?
Shit happens.
Yeah. Make sure you turn the gas on next time, okay? If you're gonna fly in a helicopter, check the gas gauge. All right. So.
That's really profound. I mean, that's just really
helpful. Good.
It's never the wound itself. It's the emotional memory of that which creates the wound.
Right. That's how you remember it. And then and then you recognize if you've got a really strong wound, you're an incredibly disciplined person. Because it's impossible. I mean, if you ask a child to remember what happened 3 days ago, do you remember when that kid kicked you in the... And they're like, You know, they can't remember something that happened unless it's their body's currently hurt. They can't remember it. You teach them how to remember wounds. You teach them how to hold against the world and resist the world. That's a taught, that is not a natural human trait. That's the insane asylum. Yeah.
Forgiveness is not about the event. Forgiveness is forgiving myself for keeping the idea alive.
Right. Yeah, and you can go to the next step, which is if somebody abused you, and let's say you're holding on to that, okay, every time you think about that, you send that person poison. So you need to forgive yourself for all the times you've killed that person in effigy. Because you've killed them a million more times, whether it be a parent or a brother or a sister or an event or whatever it is, every time you think of it, you bring up that negative energy. That negative energy radiates out in the world and sends that person a little like, if I could just give you one of these. And you know through healing work that that's actually going on. That you actually, your intention actually affects the person you're thinking about. Because when you bring them into your energy field, hey! when you bring them into your energy field, you're actually doing healing work on them. So then the question is, what kind of healing work have you been doing? And usually, what does Carolyn Mace call that? Sending your spirit on a negative mission. Okay? So your vow to never forgive a person or to always judge them or worse, forgive them. Because isn't that there's the least, you know, what do you call that? That's no respect, right? Because you forgive them because you feel sorry for them. Ah, you poor bastard. I can't believe you even lived that life. Son of a bitch. Yeah. But I forgive you. God, you know, go on with your days, you poor sap. That's a lot of forgiveness in there. Boy, that makes my heart just warm right up. So you need to forgive yourself for the way you've been forgiving everybody. No, and a couple of you had in your homework said, my best thing I do is I forgive. I'm like, oh my God, you need to forgive yourself just for saying that. All right, Magical Kitchen. We're going to be done in 15, and then we're going to do your practicums. So actually, we're going to be done in 5. So let's do a couple minutes on this and a couple minutes on the track of love. So, Magical Kitchen. How did that work for you? Did everybody? That was such a beautiful image, wasn't it?
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and how often have we begged for love? That's even one of my. That's one of my. I make my own. You know, the archetype cards. We had to. My prostitute is not the. I mean, that card is called begging for love. Mm-hmm. I spent 25 years in my first relationship begging for love.
Absolutely.
I know what it feels like. It comes up every day in a different way. It's like, how do you, you know, that feeling like I want this thing, but this person can't give it to me. So rather than accepting this person can't give it to me, you beg for it. Because you don't feel you're worthy of really asking for it. There's a huge difference. When you beg for something, you don't get it. Because even if they gave it to you, it wouldn't be enough because that wasn't the problem. Your wound, that need for love, that desire for love, you have to accept that that's who I am. I am that. And it's not this person that gives it to me. The world is not out there. There is no love out there. If you are in a relationship trying, begging for love all the time, you have to ask yourself, why don't I love myself enough to find a relationship that does love me the way I want to be loved? And that's and ultimately that then gets back to, I don't deserve to have happiness. I don't deserve to have that be that wonderful, playful, happy child. I'll put up with this and beg. It's difficult. I mean, I really, it's, you know, it's a painful part of my history. But at the same time, it really taught me a lot. You know, I didn't recognize it while I was doing it because it was just a pattern of self-hatred. So what else? With a Magical Kitchen, I mean, that's the truth is that you got all kinds of juice in there, right?
I read that and then I went to a park. I read that and then I meditated on it and I filled myself with love and self-love. And then I went to a party and just was like, And everybody's like, oh, can we come and sit next to you, sir? It was amazing. It was amazing. It was so different.
Yeah.
To be in that experience of self-love with myself and not having to beg for love. Because I've begged for love for most of my life, so I definitely could relate to that.
Right.
And just not having to do it felt so freeing for me.
Yeah. And for each of you, just understand, begging for love looks very different.
Yeah.
Charismatic leaders, begging for love is, you love this the way it is. That's begging for love. That's a completely insane, you know, rigid, you know, way of terrified about actually being open. You know, rule keepers, you know. I need you to be here on Thursday from 3 to 5, and then we're gonna have dinner on Wednesday, and we'll be doing this, and that's begging for love. It's like we'll have lots of love in our life, and we go skiing on the weekends, and we do this, and each so just recognize each one is going to have a different way they beg for love. You know, your begging for friendship is just crazy.
Yeah.
But of course, as a team player, it's going to be the thing you're going to try to do. You're going to beg for people to love you. And it's just like, when you are who you are, people can't get them out of your life. They run you over trying to become your friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for the charismatic leader, too, it's you know, people will fall over themselves to appreciate you and love you and honor you. You don't have to be, you know, perfectly and isolated and you know, not needing of, I don't really need any of you. You know, that's not true.
That's
poor me begs for love. Just hands, knees, honey, please, why don't you? Whee! Ah! Like that. Every way possible, they beg for love. Okay. All right. So we can have some more fun with that. So how did anybody have anything that really came up for that from the Magical Kitchen for you? You get the whole concept though, right? Yeah. Okay. Lastly, track of love, track of fear. These are the things that remember in the track of love. You know, you can pretty much look at these things and it was obligation, expectation, respect. Love is ruthless, responsible. Love is kind and unconditional. So in the track of love, there are no obligations. In the track of fear, everything's an obligation. Okay? And then in obligations, what's the problem? If I tell you you have to do this, immediately you hate it.
Yeah.
So if you are obliged to love your partner, it's never going to work. If after you're married, you are obligated to love your partner, you are in big doo doo.
We should just never get married.
Well, I didn't say that. Maybe love them. But you're anytime you have an obligation, you're going to resist it. And anytime you resist life, any type of life, you go into suffering. So obligation is the core, is the source of suffering in relationship.
I guess what I really mean by that is that why a lot of people say it seemed like it changed right after we got married.
Right. Absolutely, yeah. And Carolyn Mace talks a lot about that. I mean, the archetype of marriage is unbelievably strong. That's why you've got to make sure you do a lot of work with your partner before you actually get married. Because I don't care how spiritual you are, when you call that vibration of marriage together, which happens in a church or however whatever kind of ceremony you have, the archetypal world just places the archetype of marriage into your relationship. And the archetype of marriage is not very pretty. It is not the archetype of partnership. It is the archetype of you will now, the man will handle the money, the woman will do this, this is how you'll operate. And you won't know why you're all of a sudden doing that sort of stuff. You won't now know why, you know, that battle begins, but it does. Until, you know, unless you're really conscious of it, that archetype steps in and you see people go into these automatic, you know, obligatory behaviors. Yeah. Yeah. So now what about expectations? How do they work in a relationship? Right, they lead to disappointment. Right, exactly. Expectations always lead to disappointment in relationships. Okay? And they're really tricky too, because it isn't just that you expect them to do things. Okay? You expect you should do things. You have expectations for what you ought to be doing in the relationship too. So now not only are you judging them as not being able to do it, you're also have an expectation for how you should be doing it perfectly as well. So expectations always lead to disappointment in you and in them. What about respect? What was this whole... Right, track of love, there's total respect. Right? What's the... And respect and responsibility sort of go hand in hand. So you respect the other person enough to let them be who they are. Right, exactly. And that's the responsibility part. The...
Let's talk about the respect that not to feel sorry for that other person, but to have compassion for that person.
Right. Yes, that's it. So it was the same thing as forgiving. You know, we talked about, you know, you poor sap, you poor thing. You know, that's really the key to love is to so how do you respect somebody who's having an issue?
I believe in you.
Yes. Your emotional intelligence specialist knows. Okay. Rule keepers, what do? You fix them, God damn it. Charismatic leaders, what do? Screw them. They figure it out themselves. Team players, we're going to do it together. Right? Emotional intelligence specialists, I don't know, I'm with them. Poor me. So, but in... la, 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 la. Thinkers, what problem? Okay, so to respect them is to say, you can do this. There's no problem you could make in your life that you aren't here to solve. Okay? And that's ultimately, as a healer, to respect your client, you can't try to save them from their illness. As a friend, you're not doing them any service by saving them from it. Reminding them that they're doing this, that they're the one who will make this choice, that they are in this and you are their friend. Love them. Love them. You love them the way they are, and you'll love them when they're done with this, or not. But what happens is that the expectation also leads to no respect, because the expectation is that I'm going to help you get out of this because I can't stand you being that way. Okay? And that's a really tough message to give somebody. I don't really like being around you when you're sick like this. So we're going to make sure you get better. That right there, that's no respect. You have to respect them where they are, as they are. This was a really cool statement. Love is ruthless.
I resonated with
that. Yeah, what?
I resonated with
that. You underlined that one in your book too? Yeah. Yeah, so what's... Why is love ruthless? Hi, Suzanne.
Doesn't let you hide it from your past. It doesn't matter. When you're going to call you out.
Yeah.
It.
Right. Right. And no, most importantly, no judgment. Right? Love is ruthless in that it never looks at anything that's happening in a judgmental, this shouldn't be happening way. So when someone comes up and says, oh my God, I have this, you know, they'll smile. Oh, that's so good. Let's work with that. You know, what would you, you know, where are we going from here? Not, you know, if I love you, this is how I'll love you, this is the right way to do it, there's just now, ruthlessly willing to accept life as it is. Saving other people is the ugliest kind of love. It disempowers immediately. Whenever you save somebody, you know, and there's one thing, you know, to go to a healer or to a chiropractor or to a doctor or to somebody that when you are in crisis and you do not have the skills to bring yourself back up to normal, but to somehow within that relationship for that physician or therapist to build into the belief that I'm the solution to your problem, that's a ugly, you know, you need me for the rest of your life. That's a very dangerous place to get to in healing work. Even though you could probably keep this person alive an extra, whatever, 20 years, is that the message you want to get across? Or is it every day you wake up and you decide, am I healed? Am I whole? Do I choose my life my way? Or as long as this person's in my life, then I'll be safe. This person's, do you become the life raft for them? Okay? So love is ruthless. Love says, I'm done. You are done. Okay? Maddie's helped me with my back some, and it's been great. And I just know, I mean, I can tell that, you know, there's going to be a day, not in the very far distant future, where she says,
You're done.
I see you. I see you no more. But that's a powerful statement of when you are back in your health, choose your life. You know.
Said that's June 11th.
And sadly, it will be. Okay. We talked about responsible for your half and not cleaning the garbage of your partner. Love is kind. Why is love so kind? Why is love kind? And why is fear not kind?
Because it's honest?
That's not how he described it. He really said it in a beautiful way. It's really important to get this. Love is kind because when you're in love, you have no problems. You would never... When you are in love, it doesn't matter what's happening. You will be kind. You will be soft. You'll be gentle. You will be giving if you're in love. If you're in fear, it won't be very kind. It'll be okay, I'll give you this, but I have this I don't know where we had it there. There's a poverty, he said, a poverty of believing there isn't enough love. There isn't enough. There isn't going to be enough. Okay? So fear isn't very kind because fear says, I can't give you all I have. Whereas love, when you're in it, you realize it's an infinite well. I can be kind to anyone. So it's really important to understand, if you're finding that you're not in a kind moment, it's also, that's sort of like, okay, boy, I'm really afraid here. And the... you know, just understand that fear, he really, really went after all of these basic concepts. All the masks you put on are all based in fear. Anger, perfection, judgment, jealousy. Every mask you put on, everyone, rage, anger, you name it, they're all afraid. Anybody who puts that mask forward is terrified to be themselves. The fear is, I can't be myself, so I need to wear a mask. And even if the mask looks like I'm totally got it together, you know, I remember I told you my favorite one at school was the no mask mask. The no mask mask. Yeah, I don't have a mask. Why would I have? You know, I'm just Reese. Come on. I was the biggest bullshitter in the world. But I really learned the material, and I found out what's the best. How can I not have a mask? I mean, that'd be great. I don't want to have a mask, so I made the no mask mask. But that was based on fear of just being pretty much a dumbass who's just winging it and trying to do the best I can in the world, and knowing I have to teach. And sometimes I just don't even know what we're going to talk about, you know. But I'll make it up as we go along, which you all know now. And that's what you love about me. So we gotta end here. So take a 5-minute break, and we're gonna come back, and you're gonna do your practicum.